Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad you all came back after the last time I was here. I was afraid I offended everybody and no one would show up. Let's, if we could, take our Bibles and turn to the book of Nehemiah. And what we're going to do in our two sessions this morning is we're going to do an overview of the book of Nehemiah. I'm not going to be able to, in these two sessions, answer every question you have about the book of Nehemiah, but I'm going to show you how the pieces of the book fit together. So you can go back once you have the framework, once you have the right structure, once you have the right scaffolding, you can go back and study the book on your own, and I think appreciate it more. We're going to do the actual text of Nehemiah in the second service, but in this first hour, what we're going to do is work through several introductory issues. Can you guys see that okay? It's a little bit small, I'm sorry, and the other slides get bigger, and if we could douse the light, that'd be great. So here's some introductory issues we want to work through just very quickly. And basically, in any book of the Bible you study, this is what you want to do. You want to get these introductory issues nailed down. Because once you nail these introductory issues down, then the book starts to open up to you.
It's a little fuzzy.
Okay, I really don't know what to do about that. What's that?
It's a little bit low.
It's a little low.
Yeah.
How's that? I really don't know what to do about the fuzziness except maybe move it forward.
That's as far as you see it.
I can read it in.
Maybe if we move this table up a little bit. Is that better? No? How's that?
That's a good work.
It's still fuzzy.
A little better, I think.
I don't know why it's acting up like that.
Yeah.
So we'll just have to do the best with what we've got. We'll start with the title of the book. The title of the book in Hebrew is Nehemiah. And this title basically means the comfort of Yahweh. And this man, Nehemiah, needed comfort because he was involved in a great task despite constant opposition. Have you ever noticed when you set out to do something for God, you get nothing but opposition? This is really the story of the book of Nehemiah. And the LXX is sort of interesting. That's the Septuagint, or the Greek translation of the Old Testament. It called First Esdras the apocryphal book of Esdras, and then the second book of Esdras was Ezra Nehemiah. So the Septuagint took those two books and thought they were one, part one and part two. The Latin Vulgate, which came along much later, was the first really to divide the books up. It called the first book of Ezra Ezra, and the second book of Ezra Nehemiah. And so we, in our English Bible, basically follow what the Vulgate has done. We do not consider the two books equal or part of the same, but we consider them to be separate books. How are we doing with that? Is the microphone not working too well? You guys hear me? How's that? Yes? Good? Bad? Okay. Who wrote this book? Well, look at Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah." So there's no doubt that Nehemiah is responsible for this book in some sense. I mean, the opening verse attributes the book to him. When you go through the book, what you see is an eyewitness testimony. There's vivid recounting of what happened. So that could have only been produced by an eyewitness. However, when you get into the commentaries, you find three options. Let me give you the worst option first. That's the middle one. An anonymous writer compiled it through the assistance of the personal memoirs compiled by both Ezra and Nehemiah. I think that's the least likely option. Probably in second place would be the idea that Nehemiah wrote all of it. The view that I hold to is that Ezra wrote some of it himself, but compiled the rest of the book through Nehemiah's personal memoirs. And there's several reasons why I sort of lean that way. For one thing, there's a lot of similarities between the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7 are almost identical. Furthermore, when you go through the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, you see a similar outlook, content, and theology. And there's a lot of traditional sources also that take the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and attribute them to the hand of Ezra. The Babylonian Talmud does this. Melito of Sardis does this. Eusebius does this. So the view I sort of lean to is that, yeah, there was a lot of material that Nehemiah himself compiled in his personal memoirs. But I think Ezra, the scribe, who's going to show up in this book, as we'll see, came along and he really put the book together. He wrote most of it, but he used, you know, Nehemiah's personal memoirs to get that job done. Let's look a little bit about Nehemiah's biography. I mean, this book is titled Nehemiah because it's about this man, Nehemiah. Well, who is Nehemiah? Well, we know several things about him. We know that he was born in Persia. We know that he was, according to chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, he is the son of Hakaliah and the brother of Hanai. Other than that, little else is known of Nehemiah. If you look down at chapter 1, verse 11, we learn that Nehemiah is a cupbearer. Now, what exactly is a cupbearer? We know that a cupbearer is the guy who ate the food that's king, took a little piece of it first to make sure it wasn't poisoned. So he kind of took the bullet for the king. Now, to become a cupbearer, you had to be a man of great skill. You had to be someone who could be trusted. So my point is the fact that Nehemiah was a cupbearer in the court of Artaxerxes, the Persian king, shows us a lot about Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a man of exemplary character. He's a man of honesty. He's a man of wisdom. He's a man of superior administrative ability. And this is the character that we're focused on in this book. Other characteristics about Nehemiah are evident throughout this book. For example, he's a man of piety. He's a man of patriotism. He's a man of integrity. And so when you're doing these character studies of these Bible books, it's always helpful to step back just for a minute and say, you know, who is this guy and what do we know about him? And so his office of cupbearer really gives us a lot of information about him. Furthermore, we know that according to the verses I have there at the bottom of the screen, he was appointed by Artaxerxes to lead the third return from Persia back to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls around Jerusalem. I'll talk about in a minute how there were three returns. See, the nation of Israel had been in captivity for 70 years under Babylon. Babylon is conquered by Persia in what chapter of the Bible? Daniel chapter 5. And so they serve out the duration of their term of 70 years, as specified by Jeremiah that they would serve this 70-year term. They serve out the remainder of the term under Persia, after Persia had overthrown Babylon, as narrated according to the events in Daniel chapter 5. And it's Nehemiah who is appointed by Artaxerxes, the Persian king. His cupbearer, Artaxerxes, appoints him to rebuild Jerusalem's walls and then go on and become Jerusalem's governor. So that's a little bit about the biography of Nehemiah. There's a few things about Nehemiah that are sort of, these are maybes. I have question marks. Some would say eunuchs those who had been castrated. Those were the people who became cupbearers. And so that would explain why we don't know a lot about Nehemiah's family. That's a possibility. Another possibility is Nehemiah obtained the role of cupbearer through the influence of Esther, who was a stepmother of Artaxerxes. So that's a possibility, a question mark, as to how Nehemiah rose to this position. But, you know, that's kind of guesswork. We don't know these things exactly. It's sort of conjecture. Now, let me move on and give you the scope of the book. And I don't really know an easier way to do this, so you're really going to have to concentrate on what I'm going to say, because what I want to do is piece together for you post-exilic history. I want to show you how all of post-exilic history fits together. And to do that, we have to know the dates of the basic kings of Persia. If you have a Ryrie Study Bible, for example, you'll see that these are the accepted dates of the various kings of Persia. So I'm basically using these dates of these kings to piece together post-exilic history for us. As I mentioned before, there are three returns. And if I were you, I would just commit these to memory. There's no easy way to do this. Just as the nation is led into captivity in three waves, one in 605, one in 597, one in 586. Okay? In the same way, the nation returned from the captivity in three waves. And it's sort of interesting to me when you look around the world and people say, well, the nation of Israel today, it doesn't believe. How could that be part of the program of God? This is the very same thing that happened with the three returns. God is at work with Israel in phases. God doesn't pull it all off at once, right? And so what we see forming today in Israel is the return in unbelief, but we know there's going to be subsequent works whereby the nation will be returned in faith. This is exactly what happened in the post-exilic world. God dealt with the nation in three different waves. There were three different returns. The first return happened in 538 under Cyrus the king, the Persian king. The book of Ezra, chapters 1 through 6, covers this time period. It goes from 538 to 515, and the purpose of that return was to do what? Rebuild the temple. 50,000 Jews returned at that time. That's return number one. Then there's the second return, and that occurs between 458 and 457. The reigning king at that time was Artaxerxes. While Zerubbabel... Here's how you can remember this. This is kind of corny. But what do you think of when you think of Zerubbabel? I think of a bouncing basketball. And Zerubbabel bounced the children of Israel right back into the promised land. Now, is that corny? Yes. But will you never forget it? No. So you'll never forget that. So sometimes you got to resort to these corny things to skip. You see, you guys won't remember anything I've talked about 2 to 3 weeks from now. But that one thing you'll remember. So we have to resort to that every once in a while. So Zerubbabel bounced the nation of Israel back into the promised land. They rebuilt the temple. Okay, then the second return happens, 458 to 457. That's the second part of Ezra. There's a space in between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Ezra. Ezra 7 through 10 deals with that time period. And the leading figure at that time period was Ezra. And Ezra came back to adorn the temple and to reform the people. That was Ezra's ministry. Then there's another gap, and then suddenly there's a third return. And this is what the book of Nehemiah is about. This return goes from 444 to 432. The reigning Persian king was Artaxerxes. The leading Jew was Nehemiah. And the function of this return was to rebuild the wall. Okay, so return number one, rebuild the temple. Return number two, adorn the temple. That basically means decorate it and reform the people. And return number three, rebuild the wall. Ezra chapters 1 through 6 covers the first return. Ezra 7 through 10 covers the second return. The whole book of Nehemiah covers the third return. And if you don't know at least this much, you're lost as to why things are happening in post-exilic history. So, here's how the whole thing fits together. Artaxerxes issues a decree allowing the third return in 444 BC. And I have the, you know, where is it getting 444 BC? I have the verses there. And if you correlate those verses with the king list that I gave earlier, you'll see it exactly. Artaxerxes issues the decree in 444 BC. Nehemiah builds the wall in 52 days. 52 days, think about that. You know that wall had been lying ruined for 94 years since the Jews returned the first time? The Jews could not return and get that wall going. It was lying dilapidated for about 92 to 94 years. Nehemiah comes along and rebuilds the thing in 52 days. With opposition, as we'll see. Now, how did it get built so fast? There's a little phrase you'll see all the way through the book of Nehemiah. The good hand of the Lord was on me. In other words, it was God sovereignly at work, allowing Nehemiah to pull this feat off. Then Nehemiah returns back to Susa, which is the capital of Persia, after 12 years. That happens in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes. So Nehemiah builds the wall beginning in 444 BC. The wall is rebuilt in 52 days, and Nehemiah goes home in 432, 12 years later. So now we've got a 7-year gap of time between 432 and 425 when Nehemiah will come back from Susa to Jerusalem. Well, what happens in that gap of time? The nation drifts away from their task, their calling. And so what does God do? He raises up the prophet Malachi. Malachi prophesies in between that period of time when Nehemiah went back to Susa. And as we'll see in a minute, he'll come back to Susa. So then, after that, Nehemiah returns after some time, chapter 13, verse 6, about 425 B.C. Why do we put it at 425 B.C.? Well, it has to occur after some time. But we believe it was Artaxerxes that let Nehemiah come back, because after all, it was Artaxerxes that let him go the first time. We know that Artaxerxes died in 424. So there has to be enough time for the nation to drift away, for the ministry of Malachi to take place. But we can't place it after the death of Artaxerxes, because we believe it was Artaxerxes that let Nehemiah come back, just like he let him go the first time. So therefore, the date is about 425. And then the book concludes with Nehemiah's ongoing reforms, chapter 13 of the book. So do you see how this whole thing fits together? The decree of Artaxerxes, allowing Nehemiah to go back the first time to rebuild the wall from Persia to Jerusalem. Nehemiah goes back to Persia after 12 years. There's a 7-year period of time where we believe Malachi was prophesying. Nehemiah then comes back in 425 and he implements ongoing reforms. Now let me put the whole structure together for you, if I could. This is the whole post-exilic history in a nutshell. Return number one begins in 538 and goes to 515, Ezra 1 through 6. Okay? That's the return number one, where Ezra records how they went back to rebuild the temple. Now we've got 58 years. We've got 58 years between Ezra, the end of Ezra 6, and the beginning of Ezra 7. Well, what happens between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7? The book of Esther takes place. The dates are all there on the board. The book of Ezra takes place between 483 to 473. So Ezra is taking place within that 50-year period. 58-year period. Ezra is taking place between the end of Ezra 6 and the beginning of Ezra 7. Esther takes place in that time period. Then, after that 58 period is over, we have the second return, Ezra 7 through 10. That takes place between 458 to about 456. Now we've got a 13-year gap. Nothing is taking place. Then the third return happens in 444. Nehemiah 1 through 12. That goes from 444 to 432. Then Nehemiah turns around and goes back to Persia. Then we've got a 7-year gap. then Nehemiah is going to come back and issue ongoing reforms between 425 and 424. So that's your whole post-exilic history right there. Now, someone tell me who the three post-exilic prophets are during this time period. What three prophets of your Bible take place during this time period? I already gave you one. It's the last prophetic book. The Italian prophet, the prophet Malachi, Malachi. Who are the other two? Zechariah and Haggai. So we've got this post-exilic history. Now we've got to figure out where Zechariah, Haggai, and Malachi fit. I've already told you why I think, Malachi prophesied in between Nehemiah's two governorships. Okay. For one thing, Malachi uses the word governor, which is a special word that only shows up in post-exilic material. For another thing, Malachi prophesied after 515 because Malachi is complaining about how the temple was not being properly respected by the Jews. That temple was completed in 515. There needs to be some time for the temple novelty to wear off because Malachi is going to be upset about the Jews for not respecting the temple. Malachi talks about the same issues that are raised in the book of Nehemiah. You take Malachi and you take Nehemiah and you put them back to back. They're talking about the same problems. Malachi makes an interesting statement in chapter 1, verse 8. He says, you know, take your sacrifices, your corrupt sacrifices, and go offer them to your governor. That couldn't be talking about the time when Nehemiah was governor, because Nehemiah made a practice not to take special perks or privileges for his job. Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 14 and verse 18. Nehemiah said, I'm not going to be on the take. Keep your special gifts to yourself. And yet Malachi is saying, take your sacrifice and offer it to your governors, kind of sarcastically. So it's speaking of a time when Nehemiah was not present. So all of that to say is Nehemiah's second governorship reformed the very sins that Malachi spoke of. So where do we put Malachi? We put Malachi between Nehemiah's two governorships, between chapter 12 and chapter 13 of the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah comes, rebuilds the wall. 12 years later, he goes home. Malachi's ministry takes place. Nehemiah returns, chapter 13, and issues ongoing reforms. So Malachi's ministry takes place between the two governorships of Nehemiah. You ever heard the saying, when the cat's away, the mouse will play? That's basically what the Jews did when Nehemiah was gone. They apostatized, and Malachi is raised up to confront that. Now, having said that, where do we put these other prophets? Where are we going to put Haggai? Where are we going to put Zechariah? Well, their names are given in Ezra 5, verse 1 and Ezra 6, verse 14. They show up during the first return to the Jews. So let me back up just for a minute. They show up during that first return. And during that first return, the Jews basically came back and they were supposed to rebuild the temple. Then they got kind of slothful about it and lazy. So what does God do? He raises up two prophets named Haggai and Zechariah. And their job was basically this: to take the nation of Israel and do this with them. Kick them right in the back end and say, start building the temple. Start building the temple right now. And you'll see that when you study these two prophets. They have different approaches that they use. Haggai is kind of like Mao, you know, he's more confrontational. Zechariah is more using the approach of, you guys, don't you realize what a great role this temple is going to play in the future of this nation? And he gives all of these eschatological visions about the temple and the millennial kingdom. And Zechariah is basically saying, don't you want to participate in that great project? So he's more encouraging them from a positive point of view. Haggai is more of a direct confrontational type of type of guy. Sometimes their tactics overlap, but that's one way to distinguish them. So these two prophets are prophesying. Haggai is prophesying about 520. Zechariah is prophesying about 520 to 518, according to chronological information given in the book. But that's where we fit those two prophets. We put them really at the tail end of that first return, because that's where they show up in Ezra. Whereas Malachi is prophesying between Nehemiah chapter 12 and Nehemiah chapter 13. During that third return, after the wall is rebuilt and Nehemiah is back in Persia for a short period of time, and then Nehemiah is going to return in chapter 13 and issue ongoing reforms. That's sort of where we put Malachi's ministry. You guys with me on this at all? So what we're doing here is we're trying to put together a structure of these Bible books so we can understand them a little bit better. Let's move into... By the way, one thing before I jump ahead. Malachi then covers a period of... Excuse me. Nehemiah covers a period of 19 years. Total. The book starts in 444 and ends in 425. So that's basically the time period of the book of Nehemiah. Let's talk a little bit more about some other issues. Let's talk about the date of the book. When was this book written? Well, it records events that took place after Nehemiah's second trip to Jerusalem, which occurred in 425. So we believe this book was written not long after, about 424 B.C. Where was this book written from? Probably from Jerusalem. Nehemiah is the governor of Jerusalem at that time, in his second governorship. Who was the book of Nehemiah written to? It's written to that third group of returnees. That third group that came back and helped Nehemiah rebuild the wall. Why did Nehemiah write the book? What's the occasion of the book? That group... Even after they saw the wall rebuilt, and even after they saw a great spiritual revival, which we'll talk about in a minute, that group started to drift away from truth. They started to wanting to become like the Canaanite cultures around them. And so the book of Nehemiah is written to them and saying, look, don't become discouraged. Don't drift away. Don't you remember the great things that happened in your own memory? Don't you remember how fast the wall came up? Don't you remember the great spiritual revival that took place under Ezra, which we'll talk about in a minute, basically Nehemiah chapters 8 through 10? And so that's really the purpose of the book. It's reminding this third group of returnees not to quit, not to give up, not to become like the Canaanites. Don't you remember the events that happened in your recent history? Purposes of the book. Here we go. Why was this book written? It's to encourage the... Remember, we're talking just about Nehemiah. That's the book we're studying. It's to encourage the post-exilic community. That's the third group of returnees. It's to encourage the post-exilic community by reminding them of God's sovereign activity on their behalf through the rapid construction of the wall, despite much opposition. Don't become discouraged as you returned into the land. Don't you remember what God did for you in your own memory? Through the rapid construction of the wall, just 52 days, despite the fact that that wall had lied dilapidated for 94 years after the first return. The second purpose of the book is to exhort the post-exilic community towards covenant loyalty by reminding them of their prior covenant renewal and Nehemiah's reforms. A great spiritual revival breaks out in the second half of the book. And the purpose of the book of Nehemiah is to remind that third group of returnees not to just assimilate into Canaanite culture, but to go back to the Mosaic law by reminding them of what happened not only in terms of the reconstruction of the wall, chapters 1 through 7, but also in terms of the great spiritual revival that took place in chapters 8 through 13. Those are the two great purposes of this book. What is the message of the book? The message is the what question. The purpose is the why question. Whenever you analyze purpose, you're asking yourself, what was the intended effect of this book on the immediate audience? And I gave you the two purposes earlier. The message is the what question. What is the book about? And here's what the book is about. It's God's sovereign work through Persian rulers and Nehemiah and Ezra in preserving the Jewish culture in post-exilic times. This is shown in God's separation of the remnant to himself politically, chapters 1 through 7, and spiritually, chapters 8 through 13. That's the point of this book. The point of the book is to show how God took the Jews and preserved them as a culture. The political element was accomplished through the restoration of the dilapidated wall around Jerusalem, despite much internal and external opposition. The spiritual element was accomplished through covenant renewal and ongoing reform. So when you step back and you say, what is the book of Nehemiah about? It's the preservation of the Jewish culture, the preservation of the Jewish nation. Here's a quick overview of the structure of the book. The book has two parts. Chapters 1 through 7 of Nehemiah is part 1. Chapters 8 through 13 is part 2. Chapters 1 through 7 involves the reconstruction of the wall. It's political rather than religious. It involves construction rather than instruction. And it focuses on the person of Nehemiah as the leader rather than Ezra. Then there's part two of the book, chapters 8 through 13. This section involves the restoration of the people. We're no longer talking about a wall. Now we're talking about people. This section is religious rather than political. It involves instruction rather than construction. And it features both Nehemiah and Ezra are playing roles here. Whereas in the first section of the book, we only see Nehemiah playing a role. We can break down that outline just a little bit more. Chapters 1 through 7 involves three things. Number one, the return to the land under Nehemiah. Chapter 1, Nehemiah's concern for the wall. He's in Persia and he's upset because the wall is not rebuilt and he knows Jerusalem is vulnerable. Chapter 2, Artaxerxes, the Persian king, gives Nehemiah permission to return. Chapters 3 through 6 is the rebuilding of the wall. Chapter 3, the wall is rebuilt. Chapters 4 through 6 is the harassment that the Jews received as they're rebuilding the wall. And then chapter 7 is the registration of the city's new inhabitants. That's how chapters 1 through 7 function. But what about the second part, chapters 8 through 13? Chapters 8 through 13 involve the restoration of the people. Chapters 8 through 10 is the greatest spiritual revival, I think, recorded in all of Scripture. Chapters 8 through 10 is the people's revival and renewal. And then chapters 11 through 13 is further registration of Jerusalem's inhabitants and ongoing reform. So that's how the book sort of breaks down. Some historical background, just very quickly. 586 is when the walls fell. It's Nebuchadnezzar that destroyed the wall. 446, Artaxerxes, the Persian king, issues a decree ordering the Jews to stop rebuilding Jerusalem. Then we have the third return under Nehemiah in 444. You can see how God changed the heart of Artaxerxes. 2 years earlier, Artaxerxes said, quit rebuilding Jerusalem. In 444, God so works in the heart of Artaxerxes that he allows Nehemiah to go back. The entire book of Nehemiah then takes place under the reign of Artaxerxes. Who are Nehemiah's contemporaries? Ezra, because he shows up twice in the book, and Malachi. What are some distinctives of this book? What makes this book special? Number one, the sovereignty of God. God is totally at work here, moving things around almost like pieces on a chessboard to set the stage for something. Number two, the satanic strategies used to distract Nehemiah from accomplishing his God-ordained purpose. Every time you do something for God, expect opposition. This book shows you how Satan works to prevent God's work from being done. Number three, prayer. This book is huge on prayer. Nehemiah has a quick prayer in chapter 1. Chapter 9 is probably one of the greatest prayers in the whole Bible. Another distinctive of this book is the doctrine of Scripture. That's one of the reasons I like it so much. Why should the Scripture be preached? Chapter 8 answers that question. The proclamation of truth leads to revival amongst God's people. And then another distinctive of the book is it's really the last historical book of the Old Testament. Now, it's true that Chronicles is written after Nehemiah, but Chronicles is not really giving new history. It's kind of reviewing history. But Nehemiah gives us really the last piece of history at the conclusion of the Old Testament era. Last thing we'll talk about before we have our break is Christ in Nehemiah. Every book of the Bible that you study, you want to ask yourself, where is Jesus here? Because Jesus in Luke 24, verse 27 and verse 44 claim to be the theme of the Old Testament. He says, the law, the Psalms, and the prophets point towards me. So if you're reading a book of the Bible and you're missing Jesus, you're probably not reading it correctly. Now, our hermeneutic, which is literal, grammatical, historical, won't allow us to find Jesus under every rock and tree. Some people see Jesus where he's really not there. Okay. However, having said that, we believe that Christ, there's some sort of contribution to Christ in every single book of the Bible. So how is Christ spoken of here? Well, I don't think there are necessarily any direct messianic prophecies in the book. However, the restoration of Israel politically and spiritually is preparation for the fulfillment of messianic prophecy. Why is God at work in the Jews in the post-exilic era, restoring them religiously, restoring them spiritually, and restoring them politically? Because somebody is coming. The stage has to be set for the birth of Messiah. Because Scripture says that the Messiah would be a what? A Jew. He will come, very clear in the Old Testament, he will come from the lineage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So God's Spirit is at work in this book showing how Israel was protected in the post-exilic world because Jesus has to be born from Abraham's lineage. God has to preserve the Jewish nation. It's very similar to what we see going on today. The millennial kingdom will be a Jewish kingdom. So what does God have to do through history? He has to preserve the Jew. And this is identical to what was happening in the post-exilic era. In fact, you see the preservation of Israel through all of these post-exilic books. The religious system of the religious system of Israel and its preservation is spoken of in Ezra, Haggai, and Zechariah. The political system of the nation of Israel is spoken of in Nehemiah. The protection of the entire race of Jews is spoken of in the book of Esther. Remember Haman and so forth, the Jews were about to be blotted out, and God rose Esther to protect the Jews. So the preservation of the race of Jews is spoken of in the book of Esther. The call of Israel back to their worship when they apostatized is spoken of in Chronicles and Malachi. All of these Old Testament books are all about the preservation of Israel, religiously, politically, ethnically, and liturgically. Why is God doing this? Because somebody is coming through the lineage of the Jew. That's the Messiah, Jesus. If God doesn't preserve Israel in this perilous post-exilic climate, there can't be a Messiah. If there can't be a Messiah, then his whole purpose is for the human race are lost. And so that's how Christ fits in all of this. Another aspect of Christ in Nehemiah is Nehemiah 2. Nehemiah 2 is the starting point. The fancy word for that is the terminus a quo. I don't know why scholars use these fancy words. I don't know why they just don't say the beginning. But they got to use a word like terminus a quo. The starting point, the terminus a quo for Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks is Nehemiah 2. Going all the way back to Daniel, Daniel predicted that from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah comes, there will be 62 sevens and 7 sevens. In other words, Daniel predicted there would be 483 years between the decree and the showing up of the Messiah. And the question is, when was that decree issued? A lot of people run to the book of Ezra for help. They find a lot of decrees in Ezra. But as you can see from the screen, all of the decrees in Ezra involve the what? Temple, not the city. Only in Nehemiah 2 do we find a decree about the city of Jerusalem. As you go through Nehemiah 2, what you'll see over and over again is Nehemiah is upset about the city, the city, the city, the city. And so when Artaxerxes issues that decree allowing this third return, that starts Daniel's clock. And this is why Jesus makes a big deal about the day of his coming in Luke 19, verse 42. So Christ, there are no direct messianic prophecies in this book, but Christ is everywhere in this book. Because the nation is being preserved politically so Christ can be born. The nation is being preserved spiritually, ethnically, religiously, so Christ can be born. And Nehemiah 2 is the terminus a quo, or the starting point, for the prophecy of the 70 weeks. So those, we're going to stop here. Those are some introductory issues to appreciate as we go through the book of Nehemiah. And in the second hour, we're going to move very quickly chapter through this book, now that we have the basic structure of the book. Yeah, Mary.
So roughly, how many people were Jews went back the third time, or when he went back to Persia? Did you know?
In the third return?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think we know.
You don't? Okay. Well, how far is it?
Between Persia and Jerusalem? It's about around 350 miles.
Oh, okay.
I know it's 350 miles from Babylon to Jerusalem. Susa, which is the capital of Persia, is a little bit more south. So I think it'd be about the same distance, would you say, about 350 miles?
I almost said a little further than 350 miles.
Okay. But the first return, there's 50,000. Remember, there's 2 to 3 million that stay behind. Disobedience. The second return is 2,000, and the third return, I don't think we know how many there were. Yeah?
Put that chart up again, Andy, please, where it's got the Lay's political system. So,
yeah. There we go. Yeah. Sorry to do the information dump on you so early in the morning, but there's really no easy way to do this. Any other thoughts or questions? All right, well, we'll stop here and then we'll come back.
Before we take a break, I was just looking at the last chapter, 13, and you talk about the preparing for the one coming, the one who's coming. Though it doesn't say anything about him coming, but it does say 26, 27... The great concern is that they were watering down the race by marrying foreign women.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, get them out. You cannot intermix this people. So.
Yeah. Yeah, he will. In chapter 13, he'll. When the cat's away, the mouse will play. That's what takes place between chapters 12 and 13. Chapter 13, he comes back. He literally starts grabbing people by the hair. And, you know, he didn't follow a tactful management style a lot of times.
But to me, that's comparing for the Messiah.
Exactly.
Keeping a pure race.
If they had not kept a pure race, the prophecies of Jesus being born from the lineage of Israel couldn't happen. Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, let's take a 10-minute break.
Okay.